This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs with Sumitra Selvaraj and Shyamala Ganesan. So earlier we were talking about, you know, how phone calls really causes some anxiety for, it seems like, a large population of us, actually. Now we're going to talk about anxiety of a different kind. Well, for animals, actually, us causing them anxiety. More and more people are, you know, kind of cottoning onto the idea of responsible wildlife tourism, which, when done well, of course, can provide a strong economic incentive for wildlife conservation. It's a major long-term source of jobs and income for the locals, and conservation experts believe that in some countries, like in East and Southern Africa, wildlife tourism is actually the primary reason that significant wildlife populations even still exist. But of course, the key thing to note here is that this is when this style of tourism is done right.
So in an article in news portal Chili Sauce, Malaysian NGO Friends of the Orangutan, or FOTO, is it Photo?
Photo for short.
Have alleged that the Sepilo Orangutan Rehabilitation Centre in Sabah is not quite following best practice rules for great ape tourism. And these are rules that have been set out by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN.
So according to that article, some of the allegations include that there's no minimum age to enter the centre. Some rehabilitated orangutans were seen back at the centre after being released. Volunteers were being rotated during the rehab process. Some visitors were not wearing masks when they were within 10 metres of the orangutans. I didn't know this was a rule. There was no shutdown period during the year. So it needs to be noted that the Sabah government, which is a member of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the IUCN, partly does fund Sepilo.
So therefore, you know, they do agree to all of that. So let's walk through some of those allegations, right? The first one states, of course, that there's no minimum age to enter the centre. So according to those IUCN guidelines, children under the age of 15 should not be allowed near great apes. So technically, they shouldn't be allowed in the centre. And the IUCN guideline states that it is important to keep as many human diseases away from the orangutans as possible, because if the primates were to be infected with a human disease, it's possible that they can never return to the wild again. And as a mother of two, I can tell you how diseased these children are all the time. Constantly.
I did not see it going in that direction, but okay.
The primates of other, two other primates.
But that's it. I actually didn't realize that it could affect their chances of being able to be reintegrated into the wild. So second, Photo has also alleged that released orangutans have been seen wandering back at the sanctuary. So this can happen when the ape is not yet ready to be away from the humans that have helped to raise it. Photo have alleged that an orangutan named Tiger was set free into the wild only for it to return to Sepilo after a few months.
Bit of identity confusion, no?
Tiger orangutan raised by humans.
Third allegation. Volunteers were being rotated during the rehab process. Now, the IUCN guidelines state that baby orangutans should be cared for and helped by the same carer and in an environment that is most closely reflects their normal habitat. Photo, however, said that the tourists from overseas are able to buy four-week volunteer stays at Sepilo, which they believe can have an can affect the well-being of the apes. I can imagine it's terribly disruptive for the apes. And I'm not a big fan of volunteerism anyway.
Precisely. But, you know, again, as we mentioned earlier, it brings in the money. But we're going to get into that a little bit later. Okay. But before that, for the fourth allegation, some visitors were not wearing masks when they were within 10 metres of the orangutan. So what the guideline states is that the apes are able to roam freely through Sepilo. So therefore, respiratory masks should be worn by both visitors and staff. But Photo have claimed that both staff and the visitors at Sepilo are regularly seen without them. So I think this is something that is a rule even in Sepilo. It's just that nobody is actually following it.
And finally, there is no shutdown period during the year. So IUCN guidelines state that the orangutan should only be seen by the public 10 days per month, and that there needs to be 3 months a year where they're completely away from visitors. But Sepilo is open all year, and therefore Photo argues this means the apes are not being given the rest that the guidelines state that they should.
So the Chili Sauce article also notes that Sepilo have not yet commented on these allegations because they need permission from the Sabah state government before they can say anything.
They haven't responded, so we're just going to wait and see. Okay. And we will follow up on that as well. So while we wait for that, we you know, we want to know whether indeed they're not following best practice guidelines. But I did, however, want to know what are some of the other best practices when visiting centres such as Apilo, which are rehab centres for wildlife, at least in name anyway. So I reached out to Dr. Nadine Rupert. She is a primatologist and she's a senior lecturer and zoologist at the School of Biological Sciences in USM. So I started off by asking her if coming into close contact with wildlife such as primates was really all that bad for them.
Okay, if we talk about rehabilitation, I think we have to really make a definition that lets everybody clearly understand what we mean with rehabilitation centers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for rehab, where especially now we're talking about primates are kept in order to be released back into the wild, it is actually the first best practice is not to interact with them too much. So only the professional handlers or caretakers, they should be the ones who can get in touch with the animals because they have to provide husbandry and professional services. But if we want to release them back into the wild, it is really important that these animals are not habituated to humans. And this is like tourists, this is like the orang kampung, everyone. And especially they have to understand now the animals have to understand that humans might even mean threat to them. So if there's any positive interactions along the way when they learn in these centers that humans just mean like positivity, you know, like hugging and giving food and all these good things, then when you want to release them back into the wild, you will always have animals that are associated to humans somehow and they seek human contacts in the future. And that's not something we want to encourage. And then the second aspect is disease transmission. So if you really get in touch with primates and we are so closely related to each other, it's not just about that we can catch any diseases from them. It's actually that we in fact might transmit diseases to them. And in centers like rehab centers, there are many primates that are kept together, for example, and disease transmission is an aspect that we really have to avoid. So for example, orangutan, they are susceptible to TB, tuberculosis, and just imagine like these critically endangered animals, if there's an outbreak in one of these centers, it might mean that all of them might actually die, right? So close contact is an absolute no-no in terms of rehabilitation.
A lot of economies, you know, they depend, and not just in Malaysia, in Africa, for example, you know, they depend on tourists flocking to these sorts of iconic national parks, these reserves, and, you know, in turn, these wildlife-based tourism that generates millions in revenues, you know, that funds the authorities that are managing these protected areas or that, you know, fund these animals that are being rehabilitated, right? So how do we strike that balance between tourism and conservation?
I mean, it's obviously it's a very, very important economic income, economic source. And if we promote ecotourism, there's always a way of trying to make it least impactful to the environment. And of course, this needs to be managed. So you were talking about national parks or like reserves where people go in and just enjoy nature, enjoy beauty. I mean, this is obviously something a little bit different from visiting rehabilitation centers where, as I said, animals really are kind of trained to be wild again. And when we just think about the implication of letting tourists uncontrolled visit those animals that are actually kind of in a treatment, let's just call it like this, you want to rehabilitate them, you want to make them wild again, then the negative impact that I have just mentioned is just undeniable. But of course, these centers also need to be financed, you have to find income, you have to keep this going, you have to keep this running. So yes, you have to kind of try to strike a balance. If we think about who are actually the orangutans, for example, in those centers, there's a variety of individuals. There's babies that were taken from the mothers. Those are the most vulnerable ones. Those are the ones that need to be taken care of like 24 hours a day. And that should be done only by really professional caretakers, only like one or two individuals per orangutan baby, for example, and really be shut off from the wild. Because again, they're also very susceptible to illnesses. But then there's also orangutans, for example, they have been found, let's say, injured and they are pretty old and they can maybe not be released back into the wild because of their injuries, because of their disabilities or for whatever reason. So there will always be some individuals that are not candidates for release. And those individuals could in some way be the flagship individuals for those centers. So it's more like you have a sort of a zoo in the front where people pay entrance and they see the orangutans that cannot be released, but they should not interact. Yeah, so they can see them, they can learn about them, they can become, they can get relatively close to them, but not, as I said, interacting with them. But in the backstage, this is off limits. This is where people, tourists, have no access. This is where the real work actually happens. This is where they, the caretakers, rehabilitate the individuals. And this means that they have to be, they have to learn everything from start. So when babies are taken from the mums, usually in the wild, they will spend at least 7 years of their life learning everything from the mothers. So it starts with learning what to eat, learning what not to eat, who's your predator, who's your friend, and so on. So all of this needs to be now trained by humans, by professionals, and this will take a very long time. So this will happen backstage. This is usually where tourists should not see it or get in touch with the animals. But of course, they can learn about the process in any of these galleries, exhibition areas, or through video materials in the front part of the center. So there must be clear limits where people can enter, what they can see, what they can do. And the professional work in terms of rehabilitation and release, this should be something that's really shut off from the public.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as let's say as a tourist, right, you know, we want that experience, right? So we want to engage with wildlife in whatever way possible. So, I mean, what should we look out for to make sure that the centres that we are visiting, I mean, sometimes they're all called rehab centres, right? And you assume you are doing the ethical thing, you know, you're doing ethical, you're spending your money responsibly. So, I mean, what are some signs that we should look out for that, you know, kind of will, you know, make your alarm bells go off that, yeah, maybe this is not quite a rehab centre. This is not really something that's benefiting the animals. It's more exploitative. So what sort of signs should we look out for?
I mean, this is very important because, as you just said, maybe there's a lot of things that are advertised as rehab that are actually not the real rehabilitation work that we as conservationists would love to see. Yeah. So you can call the center rehab center, you can call it conservation center, you can call it whatever you want, but for real rehabilitation or something that's beneficial for the wildlife, from my personal opinion, it should be very transparent. They should have a very good educational outreach branch that will tell the tourists, the visitors, what they are actually doing. And this includes, firstly, what I've just mentioned, like some sort of gallery where they show videos and pictures and a lot of information material about what's actually going on backstage.
Right.
But then these backstage areas will be off limits. And secondly, there can be, of course, animals shown to the visitors, and they can be, and these are usually the ones, as I said, that are not release candidates, that have no chance to survive in the wild for what reason ever. It can be age or it can be injuries and so on. But those, yes, they can be shown to the public, and this is what the public might pay for to come and see. But when the public learns that, okay, these are the ones we rescued, they don't have a chance to be released, they should also understand that it is not encourageable to engage with them in a way of touching them, taking selfies with them, hugging them and feeding them and all these things. And this is where the education part is really, really important, because I think once you explain to everybody, see, this is why you shouldn't touch the wildlife, this is why you shouldn't feed them, why you shouldn't take selfies, although they cannot be released, is still, they can get diseases, it's still, they can get aggressive towards humans and all that. But once you tell people, I think all of them will understand, everybody will understand that when you contribute to the center and the fantastic work that they're doing in the background, although you're not allowed to see it like firsthand and go there backstage, people will still be happy to pay for it, because they can be assured that what they are paying for will actually benefit the wildlife in terms of those that are rescued in front, they will have a good life in captivity, and those in the back have actually a chance of being released and being back in the wild without human interactions, without contact.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, the issue is, of course, that once the wildlife gets so used to us, they're also going to come back and look for us as well, isn't it, when they're hungry or when they need something, and that's just not going to happen.
That's the thing. Like, if you think about rehabilitation in terms of teaching a young baby until the age of, let's say, 7 to 10 years, how to survive in the wild. And you do it, and it's a very long, long, long process. But if you do it the right way and you find a proper release site where this then individual, once it's like adult, once it's capable of surviving, is being released, maybe far away from human, like kampung or contacts, then it will have a chance really to thrive. But if you release an individual that's not ready to be released, that's not, that has not yet learned all these survival skills, and of course they are so dependent, because they learn, as I said, they learn from the mothers. So they will try to find human contact. They will try to go back to where they once being trained. It's their home. Like, they have not learned anything else apart from being in that center for the whole of their life. So they will try to find again humans that can somehow support them. So it's very, very important to make an assessment, to really understand the individuals once you want to release them. It's a long scientific process as well. You have to monitor them. You have to make sure that this candidate that is being released is absolutely ready to be back in the wild. And the release site must be feasible, must be suitable. There must be enough food, trees, there must be less predators, then, I mean, the density of predators must be low, not so many like human impacted areas around them. So it's, again, not easy to find a suitable site. But these factors, all these factors should be considered when thinking about release. And yeah, it's not easy. I mean, definitely it's a big task and it requires a lot of time, money, manpower, commitment, and of course knowledge how to do this, but it's possible. And this is the thing, what we don't want, we don't want to release animals that are not ready and seek human contact again, and then they might cause trouble, they might come into your kampung, people might get scared for whatever reason, they might even be threatened or shot, I mean the animals. So this happened before in other countries, so the scientific knowledge of how to do it and the expertise and the commitment and long-term also funding is really, really important to keep this process going and do it in the right way.
That's right. So I guess, you know, I mean, the crux of it is just that we should, as I mean, I think IUCN have given guidelines, isn't it? And it says that we should limit as much interaction with animals that are, you know, being attempting rehabilitation. So I guess, you know, as tourists and as, especially if we want to go and volunteer at places like this, we need to remember that we should listen to the science first before, you know, putting our own personal needs at first.
I mean, definitely, these guidelines are, they are established by experts in the field. They are not just there for, you know, just, oh, I want to say something for fun. It's something that people were scratching their heads for a long, long time. So how can we do it the best way? And they give recommendations. And it's fantastic that these guidelines exist. So now everybody who wants to do it, they can just follow these guidelines. And as I said, it's not easy. It's, I mean, of course, because especially for orangutans, they have such a long lifespan. They are so intelligent. They are, as babies, they are so needy, just like human babies. So, but these guidelines exist, and it's very, very encouraging that people talk about it and people are actually now getting more aware of how to do it the best way. And I think that's, it's very, very good to just encourage everybody, not just in Malaysia, but in Indonesia and places where these rehab centers exist, to follow certain standards and just do it the best way possible.
All right. So as tourists then, you know, if we really want to volunteer, we really want to get that experience with wildlife, I mean, what should we be mindful of, you know, and what should we look out for when sort of choosing a center to go to?
Okay, I think first, as I said before, when you look at these advertisements, there must be a lot of information already given in the advertisements of the do's and don'ts during your volunteering.
That's right.
For example, volunteers who come for a very short period of time in these rehab centers, they should only be allowed to do some housekeeping jobs, let's say like this, like cleaning cages or preparing food, maybe not even serving the food, but like really just some jobs that don't make them directly interact with rehabilitation candidates. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm talking about rehab candidates. I'm not talking about those, again, that cannot be rehabilitated.
Right.
They could, for example, yes, they could, I don't know, in some way maybe interact more with those that are only rescued. They cannot be released in the future. But again, close interactions are always is not encouraged. But sometimes it's necessary for veterinary treatments or whatsoever. But what I'm saying, volunteers should be given clear information about what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And if the center tells them, oh, you can take selfies, you can hug, you can touch the animals, that's usually like a warning flag already. And if you are like a very conscious person and want to know what is a good center or not, then you should really look out for these signs. So less interaction means better conservation efforts. And usually paying for doing these jobs as a volunteer, of course, is something that is necessary for these centers to find income. But it doesn't mean that you as a volunteer are allowed to do everything just because you pay. So it really, you really should be conscious about what's best for the animal, not what is best for you. Even you want to have this experience, if you understand that with your work, and is it only cleaning cages or preparing food, you're really contributing to the good practices to conservation of these centers, then this should be satisfying enough for you. So think about whether you want to do it for you or for the animals.
So that was Dr. Nadine Rupert, who is a primatologist and a senior lecturer and zoologist at the School of Biological Sciences at University of Science Malaysia. So I guess the takeaway, you know, read up about a wildlife park or centre or zoo or a rehab centre, you know, ask the questions. Don't be a sitting duck, you know, and really getting that selfie is really not that important. Definitely don't touch them. I mean, how many times have we actually touched a wild animal without even thinking about, you know, what we've been touching or what weak creams we've put on our hand, you know, which might not actually gel with them. but how about you? You know, I'm sure you guys like wildlife tours as well. You know, what are some rules that you have in place for yourselves?
I love animals. And you know, I'm not ashamed to admit that from when I was a young child, my parents took us to some of the world's best zoos. And it was a fantastic experience. As I grew older, I kind of came to realize that going to zoos is perhaps not the best way to support the conservation efforts, right? So what Sashi and I do is, my husband and I, we love animals, so we go to wildlife reserves wherever we travel to. And I have come to the understanding that I am going to a wildlife reserve. If I happen to see a wild animal in a wildlife reserve, great. Mm-hmm. But if I don't, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay too, because I've gone to see them in their home, and if they choose to show themselves to me, fantastic. And if they don't, the satisfaction level is still there because I've gone for a beautiful nature experience.
Yes, yeah? And you know that you've spent your money ethically. You know that money is still going to go towards supporting them, whether or not they appeared for you.
Rather than exactly having this whole thing of having animals being dragged out for your own pleasure and entertainment. Yeah. It's just...
So one of the things that I've started trying to do is as much research as I can about any attraction that involves animals, especially wild animals. And if anything at all looks dodgy or rings a, you know, alarm bells, I don't do it. I want to be, and it's not always easy. It's not always easy to get all of the information. You sometimes have to cross-reference different websites. You have to read reviews. But it's worth taking that effort, right? Because at the end of the day, you don't want it to turn into a self-indulgent exercise.
Mm-hmm. No.
Yes, learning more about the world, learning more about the beings that we share our earth with is an amazing experience, but it shouldn't come at their expense.
Exactly. That is why we're in trouble as it is, right? Yeah. So, yeah. So just to be a bit more mindful about that. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but you can always continue the conversation. You can always send us a tweet at BFM Radio. You can send us a WhatsApp message at 018-789-8899, or you can look us up at on Facebook. Just look for BFM The Bigger Picture. And if you miss any part of the show, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/dailydigest. You can look us up on the BFM app or on Spotify. We're going to leave you now with Don't Bother Me by The Beatles. This has been The Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.